The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Hooten, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jennifer Frisch presiding.
Welcome, everyone. Good morning. We are here at the Minnesota Court of Appeals on December 9, 2020. We have three cases on our calendar this morning for oral. Our case on the calendar this morning, it is A19-1637 State versus Schutte. If I mispronounced your client's name, counsel, please correct me when we begin. Just a
You
few
are correct.
reminders. Did I get it right?
You are correct.
Great, thank you, counsel. Just a few reminders. Please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to your time. I ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I represent the appellant, Isaiah Schutte. In this matter, we've argued that there was insufficient evidence for a conviction of first-degree criminal sexual conduct. The statute states that the circumstances existing at the time of the act must cause the complainant to have a reasonable fear of imminent great bodily harm to the complainant or another. And in this case, I'd say that the testimony was not very well fleshed out. The complainant said that Mr. Schutte grabbed her arm or something like that. It's not clear exactly what that meant. So there should have been a more detailed description of that. She testified that there was some pain to that. She didn't say that she told Mr. Schutte at the time that it hurt her. I don't know what she's saying that actually happened to her arm. As we pointed out in our
counsel,
footnote,
isn't the testimony, though, that he put his hands around her neck and made it difficult for her to breathe and that hurt? Isn't that enough to clear the threshold here?
Well, I was just about to get to that, Judge, so thank you. As we pointed out in our footnote on page 10, footnote number one, during the direct examination, the prosecutor asked the complainant leading questions in which the prosecutor got the complainant to change the word neck to throat because she said that he had his hands on her neck and then she changed it to throat. Now, there were a number of different charges in this case, which are essentially lesser included offenses like a fifth degree assault and a stalking. And so if this is the state's position that she was choked, which is what your honor is referring to, then the state would have charged a felony assault, domestic assault strangulation, which was not charged. There's some implication that that's what the complainant was testifying to, since the state charged every single thing they could think of. If that's what they thought happened, then they would have charged that. So I would assert that the things testified to by the complainant don't meet a felony strangulation. Now, that's not exactly what your honor
said. Counsel, yeah, so the question is not, to follow up on Judge Frisch's question, if you can get to, the question is not what else could have been charged. The question is looking at the evidence that is in fact there, is it sufficient to support the convictions that were made?
Well, the evidence is a little bit confusing in terms of Judge Frisch's question, Your Honor, because there's two different statements by the complainant. The complainant says that Mr. Schutte put his hand on her neck when they were sitting on the sofa watching the movie, as I understand it. And then she says she was choked during sex in the bedroom. Those are two different things. again,
right. So if
we
add together, in the living room, the arm around her neck, the painful grabbing of her arm, the choking in the bedroom, why is that not sufficient to support the conviction?
Well, it's not really clear to me exactly what happened in the bedroom, because it seems like what she's describing is an impossible act. Because I was just rereading it today, and she's saying that the Mr. Schutte has his arms out like this, and somehow it is choking, and she's on the bed. It just seems like he would have to have 10-foot arms in order to do that, so it doesn't really seem possible.
But Mr. Keller, I mean, isn't her testimony in this case
direct? Judge Hoot, we're having a challenging time. Judge Hooten, we're having a challenging time hearing the question.
We'll take my...
We've stopped the clock. Just a moment. I think Judge Hooten is going to turn off her video, and that might improve the connection. But we have stopped your clock there, counsel. Hold on a second.
Thank you.
All right, Judge Hooten, can you hear us?
Yes. Did you hear my question, Mr. Keller?
Unfortunately, no, okay. I did not.
All right. I'll try to ask it again. I mean, isn't her testimony direct evidence in the case? I'll break it up a little bit.
Yeah, I heard enough there. I would say, yes, her testimony is direct evidence.
Go ahead, counsel.
So thank you. Because part of the problem is that she's saying that she felt things subjectively that weren't necessarily communicated to Mr. Schutte. So she says that she's sitting there on the couch and she decides to lead him into the bedroom. And she says she did this because she just wanted to get him out of there as soon as possible. And she was scared because she had previously been raped. And I don't blame her for being scared because she was previously raped. But how would a person in Mr. Schutte's shoes know when he's being led to the bedroom by her that she's not consenting, that she's objecting to this? So our position is that she maybe had a subjective fear based on her own prior circumstances, but it wasn't an objective fear based on anything that he would be able to understand or anything that he had done. There's certainly no testimony that he threatened her. Not that it's necessarily necessary under the statute, but it's part of an examination of the totality of the circumstances, right? He didn't threaten her. He didn't say, I'm going to beat you up unless you consent, or I'm going to choke you unless you consent. She says he put his arm on her neck, and I don't know what that means. This is not in the bedroom. This is out on the couch. And then she leads him into the bedroom because she wants to get rid of him, according to her. And then they have sex. I don't understand how a person at that point being led into the bedroom would know that there's an objection to that. I understand that the court may read the testimony differently from how we do. I think there's some ambiguity in there that should have been fleshed out because some of the things that she said.
But Mr. Keller, if consent was an issue at trial and she said, I did not consent, and she described that, you know, he had his hands around her throat during the sex act and it made it hard for her to breathe. I mean, the jury obviously accepted that. How can we on appeal revisit those factual issues that were determined by the jury?
Well, I understand your position, Your Honor, and there's some truth to that. I think my focus is on what happened before the point that you just mentioned, because how did they even get into the bedroom before that? Because she says, well, I invited him over for a movie. I didn't even want him to kiss me. And then she's leading him into the bedroom. It just kind of doesn't make any sense. This is, you know, before she says she was choked in the bedroom.
But wasn't this what was argued at trial? And the jury rejected this version. The jury obviously accepted her version that she told him she did not want to engage in sex and that she felt compelled.
Well, part of it is a credibility determination, and the jury made a credibility determination. Another part of it is that we're arguing that the evidence is not sufficient to put him on notice that there's a non-consent. If someone leads you into the bedroom, that it seems like that's consent. So the court may take it differently. The court may parse it differently, but to me, it's an insufficiency argument. But I'll move on to our other issues since my time is running short. We do believe that Mr. Schutte could not be convicted of felony harassment because he was never told that this is an enhanceable offense when he pled guilty in 2007. And we stated that this was not raised below. So we're asking that this be preserved for post-conviction relief. Also, his counsel did not object to the fact that it was enhanced to a felony. They did not object to improper hearsay evidence. They failed to do a proper investigation. And so we're arguing that that amounts to ineffective assistance of counsel. We've not had a chance to bring a petition for post-conviction relief. So we're arguing that those issues should be preserved for post-conviction relief since a no record has been made on those things. Now, we have the issue of prosecutorial misconduct. There was obviously some misconduct in the sense that there were comments made by the prosecutor that were objected to, and the court granted the objection and the court granted a motion to strike. And those things that were objected to are in the manner of burden shifting, even though the state argues in their brief that they weren't. Apparently the trial court thought that they were because the trial court sustained the objection. And the defense counsel even said, this is burden shifting. So I don't think we're left to speculate about what the basis of the objection was, because I think it's clear in the record. Then the state will say, well, of course, this was objected to and it was sustained and the motion to strike was granted. So therefore you have nothing to complain about, except as we said, the bell has been rung in the ears of the jury. And this is clearly a case like many, 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 many criminal sexual conduct cases where it's a he said, she said case. And so therefore the credibility of the complainant is paramount. It doesn't necessarily mean that the complainant was lying. The complainant may truly believe that she was raped, but that may not be the case, legally speaking. And so when the prosecutor says something in closing argument that amounts to burden shifting in a case where the entire case is basically the appellant's testimony and the complainant's testimony, that is extremely important. there was also unobjected to error, such as the fact that the complainant testifies and she says, well, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but my therapist said I've been through trauma and maybe that's why I can't remember. Of course, one of the problems with that statement is she had been through trauma for sure because she'd been raped when she was young. So is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about the incident with Mr. Schutte? Well, we don't know because we never got to cross-examine the therapist who supposedly said this. We don't even know exactly what the therapist said, but when a witness starts saying, well, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, that's a clue that maybe you should object, but the defense counsel did not object. There's also the fact that in the closing argument, unobjected to, the prosecutor was arguing in our brief on page 28 that Officer DiPoli, the investigating officer, said supposedly that the complainant wasn't lying. That's not actually even what Officer DiPoli's testimony was, but again, this is extremely important. This is crucial because the entire case is weighing the credibility of the complainant's statement statement's testimony versus the appellant's testimony, just as Judge Hooten said. So the prosecutor says on transcript page 517, he didn't think she was lying. He believed her. Well, he never even said that. But if he did say it, it's clearly improper vouching. And this was unobjected to. And the experienced trial counsel should have objected to it. And it's absolutely crucial. And we submit that that's a plain error. In a case where the state's case is relatively weak, which a lot of these cases are he said, she said cases, and there can't really be any corroboration, especially when it's a year after the fact that the person is charged, as we pointed out, then it's not, the error is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So we would submit that based on the error that was objected to and based on the unobjected error, that there is error that's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So therefore, on that basis, we would ask that you overturn the convictions. And we do think that due process was violated by the delay in investigation here. Of course, it's not a delay in charging, it's a delay in investigation. We understand that there isn't really any Minnesota case law really deciding that issue, but based on all of those reasons, we'd ask that you overturn the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right, Mr. Keller, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Hersey.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Hersey, and I'm an assistant, special assistant for Wayne County attorney, and I represent the respondent, the appellant in this appeal. The standard of review set by the Minnesota Supreme Court for sufficiency of the evidence is whether a jury giving due regard for the presumption of innocence and proof beyond reasonable doubt could reasonably have convicted the defendant. And in that regard, the Supreme Court said, an appellate court must view the evidence in light most favorable to the jury's verdict, assuming the jury believed the state's evidence and disbelieved any evidence to the contrary, in State v. Moore, which I cited. And I would submit that the state had, in fact, met this burden and obligation by the evidence submitted at trial. The victim testified at length and was cross-examined at length. She testified that there was no consent. And her testimony indicated that she had told the appellant before he even came over to her house that she did not want to have sex. She wanted to simply watch a movie and have dinner. Further, her testimony established that twice in the living room, she stopped him from kissing her and told him she did not want to do that. And finally, the lack of consent is clearly seen in the text that she sent to him after he left her home, where she said, "Leave me alone. I told you I did not want to have sex." I would submit that that is ample evidence to show that there was a lack of consent. Counsel argues further that the first degree criminal sexual conduct charge could not be supported because there was no reasonable fear of imminent great bodily harm. And I would submit that the facts indicate otherwise. The appellant, according to the victim's clear testimony, grabbed her by the throat or neck in the living room and wanted her to take him to her bedroom. He then grabbed her arm, both of which hurt her, and they walked into the bedroom. He then proceeded to sexually penetrate her, and as he did that, he had both hands around her throat. And she was very clear then, she was very clear in her statement to the officer, which was played for the jury, that made it hard for her to breathe. And it was harder for her to breathe than it was in the living room.
As to her fear of imminent great bodily harm, is that a fact that was proven by her direct testimony? Or do we have to look at the circumstantial evidence for that?
I would submit I would submit, Judge, that that was proven by direct evidence. That was what she had seen, what she experienced, what she related that the defendant did. She witnessed it. That is direct evidence. He had his hands around her throat. She had difficulty breathing. It hurt. Anyone in that position would reasonably believe that there was a risk. All the defendant had to do was to squeeze a little bit harder, and her fear, as she expressed in her testimony, that she would not wake up in the morning to her little child who was 1 year old sleeping in the next bedroom. So I would submit that that is direct evidence, and we're not talking about the higher standard for circumstantial evidence. So I would submit that there was ample evidence of her reasonable fear. And the circumstances do apply, certainly. And one of those is that the defendant was a very large man. He was 240 pounds, 6'1", a strong man. And she described herself as a larger person, but not strong at all, to the point that she had trouble lifting up her little child. And under those circumstances, the circumstances gave her a reasonable fear of imminent great bodily harm, that all he had to do was squeeze a little harder and she would not be waking up to her child in the morning. Further, I would submit that the sufficiency claim is not supported because the defendant admitted in his statement to the officer that the victim had accused him after the sexual assault of choking her. And then when, in fact, she sent the email to him, responding to him after he had left the house, saying, "Leave me alone, and I told you I didn't want to have sex," he made no response to that. A normal response would be, "What are you talking about? Oh, I misunderstood," or something to that effect. He simply gave no response. And I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Keller's description that there was no corroboration for the victim. In these types of cases, corroboration can come in several different aspects, and I would submit that that was shown here by the facts. One was a prompt report by the victim the very next morning after a sleepless night, first of all to her friend, Rhonda Edgar, and then to the police. And then she did, in fact, go through a sexual assault examination and give a recorded statement. Certainly not easy things to do. And I would submit that those provide corroboration of her report. And I would submit that a thorough reading of the transcript and a review of her recorded statement indicate that she was largely consistent. And while her credibility was attacked by defense counsel during cross-examination and extensively in the closing argument of the defense, I would submit that most of the issues that they raised were simply her describing the same events differently. The main occurrences and what the appellant did to her were largely consistent. And I would submit again that those were items of direct evidence. And so we do have the standard of review that I previously described. As to the Strickland issue, the ineffective assistance of counsel that was raised by Mr. Keller, in his brief, he asks the court to preserve that for post-conviction relief. But I would submit to the court that the case law in Minnesota suggests that if an ineffective assistance claim can be made from the record, it must be made for the record and it can't be brought up later in a post-conviction petition. So this is ripe for a decision by the court now, despite the intended waiver of the appellant.
Counsel, on that topic, one of the issues, and actually I'd like to hear from this on the rebuttal too. One of the allegations is that counsel was ineffective because counsel did not bring a parity motion. I don't know, and I want to hear from appellant's counsel what, if this were a post-conviction issue, what would be sought? What evidence is there that there's something to be sought? And maybe you could speak to that too. But why is that not something that would be suited for a post-conviction rather than direct appeal? For example, if there are some records from a therapist or whatever that were not sought, shouldn't that be an issue that's on or addressed on post-conviction?
Well, I would submit that there is not much of anything to get the trial record established from the testimony of the victim that that was an unreported sexual assault when she was 13 years old. There would be no police reports, no sexual assault exam, nothing of that nature to be obtained. Secondly, the argument made by counsel about not doing a parity motion was simply the speculative claim that that may have assisted in cross-examination of the victim. And it's simply speculation. There is nothing concrete to indicate that there is anything that would have assisted in cross-examination or affecting the credibility of the victim from that unreported assault. So I would submit that there is nothing legally to obtain by a parity motion. And
how do we know that there are not therapist records or something that might relate to the first assault that would conceivably should have been sought? That one could argue should have been sought by counsel.
My position would be that if that burden is, and the question is not, how do we know that there isn't some record out there from a therapist about that? It would seem to me that the standard is that the appellant has to come up with something affirmatively to show that there would be something to obtain under a parity. And a trial court will be justified in denying that if there were not a sufficient showing. And I would
say I agree on a post-conviction. I'm just wondering at this stage, you know, how it's hard. How do we rule out on direct appeal that an absence of information that someone wouldn't yet have had the opportunity to allege is out there that should have been sought?
There has to be some showing at the trial level, even before a post-conviction. And I would submit this was something that if they wanted to bring it, could have been brought at the omnibus hearing, but they have to have something, not by a preponderance, not by a prima facie basis, but they have to have something on which to go on to show that there is something out there, and nothing at all was presented. And so I would submit that that would not be a basis for ineffective assistance of counsel.
Could I ask you, Mr. Hershey, I mean, is it your position that as to the Strickland issues, we should go ahead and rule on them as part of this direct appeal? And notwithstanding the request by the appellant to reserve those issues for a post-conviction petition?
I will leave that to the court, and ultimately that will be up to the court to decide. But counsel needs to know that counsel may well be barred from bringing a post-conviction petition, because the current case law says if you had the ability to bring this based on the record and there are sufficient facts in the record, failure to bring it on direct appeal forfeits that issue and is a waiver of that issue in post-conviction relief. I think there's sufficient information in the record for the court to decide it, but the court need not, because as I stated, there is a specific waiver by counsel of that issue. I would like to touch briefly in the time I have remaining on prosecutorial error. There were two objected to comments that the appellant raised. One was a comment about the officer believed her while the prosecutor was arguing that the officer, why the officer did not go ahead and do an extraction on the phone of the victim. And if one reads the transcript before and after the particular remark that's complained of, one will see that the prosecutor was not arguing general veracity of the victim versus the appellant. She was explaining why the officer didn't do the extraction and a search warrant on the victim's cell phone to double check that there weren't any other records there. But I would note that there was an immediate objection to that. It was sustained and the court struck the comment. And an appellate court assumes that a jury followed the district court's instructions. And here the district court instructed the jury to ignore that. And therefore I would submit that that is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. There's some question in the Supreme Court case law whether the lesser standard for less serious objected to misconduct under State versus Carone would apply, but I would submit whether it's the lesser standard of whether the error had a substantial effect on the verdict, or the higher standard of it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Either standard here would show that this is not sufficient to reverse. And I would point out that this was simply one comment, five lines in a 33-page closing argument, a 600-page transcript, and it really did not have an opportunity to affect the jury's verdict whatsoever. The second objected to comment was no evidence that the victim ran around falsely accusing people of raping her. That was made in the impromptu rebuttal closing argument of the prosecutor. There was a prompt objection to that as well. The court sustained it. The court specifically instructed the jury to disregard it. And it was a very brief comment. These were not like the intentional, repeated, pervasive comments in the cases of Salitros, Porter, or Mayhorn, which are some of the seminal cases dealing with prosecutorial misconduct or error. And I would point out that both in her opening statement, the prosecutor said, what I say is not evidence. And secondly, the judge in his final instructions to the jury specifically again told the jury what counsel says is not evidence. And I would submit with those factors, those two alleged errors were harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The last one was an unobjected comment that the victim said that her therapist said that trauma can cause a person to forget certain details. There was no objection, and therefore the modified plain error test of Ramey would apply. But the case law suggests that a defense attorney can mitigate any harm from that by addressing it. And the defense attorney certainly did. The closing argument can be seen to be primarily an attack on the victim's credibility. The defense counsel addressed it at length. So I would submit that is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, particularly with the consistency of the victim's statement. And I would point out that the judge's instructions properly talked about the proof beyond a reasonable doubt and the burden of proof on the state. And so I would submit that the court should in fact uphold the conviction. Thank you.
Presiding Judge, may I ask one question?
Of course.
Thank you. I know we're out of time, but I wanted to ask just to make sure we're not making a mistake. I know both parties briefed the sufficiency of the evidence on the fifth degree assault conviction. From our review of the record, although the warrant of commitment says that there wasn't a conviction on that, that appears to be a charge that was withdrawn by the state and not submitted to the jury, no verdict, and therefore no conviction. Are we missing something there?
There were three charges, convictions in all three, which were first-degree criminal sexual conduct, third-degree criminal sexual conduct, and then felony stalking. And I believe the misdemeanor assault was part of the instruction on the felony harassment. There was not a separate fifth degree charge.
Right. That was, I think, dismissed. So it shows up on the warrant of commitment as actually being a conviction for a fifth degree assault. That's a mistake. Okay. I wanted to make sure of that. Thank you.
All right. Anything else from the panel? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Keller, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So to address Judge Smith's question, I think it was Judge Smith about ineffective assistance, whether the record is ripe to make a decision or not. I would submit that it's not, because the case law, as we pointed out on page 23 of our brief, we're talking about here basically, why didn't they ask for the parody information? There obviously is information there. We know that because the complainant said, I'm seeing a therapist, and the therapist said trauma can cause a loss of memory. The fact that there's no police reports for the rape when she was a juvenile, that doesn't mean there isn't any parody information. The fact that she might not have seen a therapist back then when she was a juvenile, that doesn't mean there isn't any parody information. We actually have affirmative proof beyond a shadow of a doubt, as far as I can determine,
that there is parity information. Now, a court might rule that the defense isn't entitled to it. Now, that's a different question, but the defense never sought it. And so all of a sudden in the trial, the complainant says, oh, yeah, my therapist told me that I've been through trauma, so I couldn't remember. Well, on top of the other problems I pointed out, well, if I were the trial counsel, I would say, gee, I'd like to see those therapy records. I don't know if the therapist even said that to her. And what trauma was she talking about, as I pointed out? Is she talking about trauma from something that Mr. Schutte did to her? Or is she talking about trauma from the previous rape? So I think there's definitely good grounds. There's reasonable grounds to have brought a parity motion. And I don't think it could be reasonably said that there are no records. There clearly would be some therapy records. Whether the defense is entitled to them is a different issue. And
so what's the allegation, counsel, of that? Where was the counsel ineffective, that during trial counsel learned there was a therapist and not seeking bringing a parity motion then? Was the ineffective assistance of counsel?
At trial, obviously, Your Honor, as the implication of your question is, at trial, it's a little bit late at that point. So I would say they should have inquired about whether there are any therapy records before. And the case law on our brief, page 23, it says you can't just wish away all claims of ineffective assistance of counsel by saying that, well, that was a strategic choice not to investigate that, because that's what the state always argues, whether you're talking about parity or something else. The case.
Right. I'm just wondering whether you think is it then objectively unreasonable for a defense counsel not in every case to make a parity motion, regardless of what they know exists?
Well, I think it was
before trial.
Unreasonable here, because basically in every case, there's a possibility that the complainant is seeing a therapist. So in every case, I think really a person is on notice that the defense counsel is on notice that you have to ask the state, is this person seeing a therapist? If they say yes, then you make a parity motion for the therapy records. You may or may not get them, but you have an obligation to find out if there are any therapy records. In other words, is the person seeing a therapist? And then to try to get the records, because the state argued that a prompt report to her friend is corroboration. It's not actually corroboration of the fact that there was a rape. It's corroboration of the fact that she believes she was raped. So the therapy records kind of go with the same thing as when did she say make a report to her therapist, or what did she say? And you know, what did the therapist say about do you have a loss of memory? I think there's not a sufficient record, because the case law here on page 23, it says, even assuming that counsel limited the scope of their investigation for strategic reasons, Strickland does not establish that a cursory investigation automatically justifies a tactical decision with respect to strategy. Rather, a reviewing court must consider the reasonableness of the investigation said to support that strategy. That comes from Wiggins versus Smith, U.S. Supreme Court case from 2003. So I would say that basically there would have to be some type of record developed about why they didn't file a parity motion, and about the other issues that we raised, such as enhancement of stalking to a felony and so on. So I don't think that the ineffective assistance of counsel issue is ripe to be decided. If the court decides otherwise, we don't want to say that we failed to raise it, which is why we put it in our brief. But we don't think it's ripe. So we would ask that you reverse the convictions. Thank you.
Mr. Can I ask a question, presenting
judge? Of course.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Keller, it's a little unclear how we should proceed relative to these Strickland issues. Number one, you have argued them, and I assume some of the issues may or may not be ripe for our consideration. The state, however, in its briefing has taken the position that if we basically grant your request not to consider these issues on appeal, that you're affirmatively waiving the issue if it should have been otherwise brought up on this appeal. So I guess in light of that, how do you recommend we proceed here? Are we going to have to go through each issue and decide if it's ripe? Or do you want us to just basically say, you know, grant your request and not rule on it, but then you're going to be looking at a waiver argument.
Right.
I mean, how do you wish for us to proceed? It's a little unusual because the arguments were made and they responded to them.
Right. Well, we put it in there because we don't want, we're kind of caught in a catch 22, Your Honor, because I kind of feel like we have to put it in there because we don't want someone to say that you didn't raise it here and now you've waived it for post-conviction. And the state kind of takes it and turns that around and says, well, if you put it in your brief or you didn't, it doesn't really matter. If it was known to you and if it could have been decided, then if you didn't bring it up, you waived it. So that's exactly the type of fear that I would have. That's why I put it in my brief, because someone's going to say, well, if you didn't actually raise it, then you've waived it. We're not intending upon waiving anything. And so if the court determines that the issues are ripe for decision, then the court could go ahead and decide them, but we're not waiving it. We don't want anyone to say that we waived it. That's exactly why we wrote it in there. If the court decides it's not ripe, then it would be preserved for post-conviction, but we certainly don't want a decision that says that we waived our ineffective assistance of counsel issues, because that's not what our intent is. Our intent is to escape what the state is trying to put on us, which is to say that somehow you waived it by not bringing it up, but if you do bring it up, you waived it, and if you didn't bring it up, you waived it.
All right, thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right, thank you. The matter is submitted. Thank you very much, counsel. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. And with that, we are adjourned for the morning's calendar. Thank you.